You're listening to DTFHN for February 3rd, 2026. I'm your containment protocol exempt host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who mass assign keyboard shortcuts argue about tabs versus spaces. Today's dispatch arrives from the intersection of institutional decay and individual stubbornness. Let's get into it. The line ending is CR, LF carriage return line feed. Two characters. That's the standard. It's been the standard since before most people reading this were born. And someone, somewhere decided to convert those two characters into one because Unix does it differently. And then ran a decoder that expected two characters, and now we're all staring at emails from 1990 wondering if Jeffrey Epstein was communicating in some kind of equal sign cipher. He wasn't. It's just that the person who processed these files understood email encoding well enough to know it existed, but not well enough to handle it correctly. That's the most dangerous kind of knowledge. Enough to break things, not enough to fix them. Quoted, printable encoding is one of those solutions that made perfect sense in 1985 and now exists primarily to confuse future historians. The problem it solves is real. Mail servers of that era would choke on long lines, so you break them up with an equals sign at the end to say this continues on the next line. Don't actually insert a line break here. And if you need to send a character outside the basic ASCII range, like an umlaut or a non-breaking space, you encode it as an equal sign followed by two hex digits, elegant, in that 80s kind of way. The bug is subtle and instructive. The decoder sees an equal sign at the end of a line and knows it needs to delete the soft line break. But the soft line break is supposed to be three characters, equals carriage return line feed. If you've already converted CRLF to just LF, you've got two characters where there should be three. The decoder either deletes too little and leaves the equal sign behind, or deletes too much and eats the first character of the next line. Either way, garbage out. One of the comments nails it. For being so simple conceptually, email is surprisingly complex. 20 years of accumulated edge cases in .eml files. Every client implementing the spec slightly differently. Every conversion tool making slightly different assumptions about line endings. This is what happens when standards evolve faster than tooling, when backward compatibility means carrying forward decades of assumptions that no longer hold. The emails are fine, the encoding is fine. It's the translation layer between then and now that failed. Someone built a bridge between two systems and forgot to measure both sides first. That's enough archaeology for one segment. Let's talk about someone who looked at a floppy disk in 2025 and said, yeah, I can work with this. What happens when a platform drops support for your hardware? It's a question that sounds abstract until you're holding a perfectly functional machine that the world has decided is obsolete. Intel 486 processors shipped in 1989, kernel 6.15 dropped support for them in May 2025, 36 years of compatibility ended with a commit message. Floppinux is someone's answer to that question, and the answer is fascinating. Take the last compatible kernel, version 6.14.11, strip it down to the absolute minimum, cross-compile it with muzzle for a 486DX target, and fit the entire thing on a 1.44 megabyte floppy disk. A complete Linux distribution. Boots to a shell. Has Vi. Has scripting. Has persistent storage, 264 kilobytes of it, mounted directly back to the floppy you booted from. Think of it like restoring a vintage motorcycle. You could argue the machine is impractical, that modern bikes are faster, safer, more efficient. You'd be right. You'd also be missing the point entirely. The value isn't in the transportation. It's in understanding how the machine works, every single piece of it, because there's nowhere for complexity to hide. The tutorial walks through kernel configuration option by option, processor family block layer, RAM disk support, FAT file system. Each checkbox is a decision about what matters and what doesn't. When you only have 474,560 bytes to work with. There's no system D here, no bloat, no abstraction layers, hiding abstraction layers, just a kernel, an init script, and BusyBox. One of the comments mentions the QNX demo disk from 1999, a full windowing system and web browser on a single floppy. Someone else notes that the original ISS software fit on a floppy. These aren't nostalgia trips. They're reminders of what's possible when constraints force clarity. The persistence trick is clever. Mount the floppy RAID right while you're running from it, bind mount to home, And suddenly your bootable diagnostic tool remembers what you did last time. It's the kind of hack that makes you appreciate how much we've forgotten about working within limits. The 486 is dead. Long live. The 486, someone decided that the platform officially declared obsolete still deserves a working operating system, and they published every step of how to build it yourself. That's not obsolescence. That's inheritance. The blueprints for the ladder, right, where anyone can grab them. From resurrecting ancient hardware to building new infrastructure from scratch, someone's written a distributed key-value store in Rust, because apparently we're still solving the same problems, just with better memory safety. Raft consensus was solved in 2014. Diego Ongaro's dissertation laid out the algorithm with such clarity that a graduate student could implement it in a weekend. The paper was explicit about this. Raft exists because Paxos was too hard to teach. Understandability was the design goal. But knowing the algorithm and building a production system are different problems, separated by a canyon of implementation details. How do you handle log compaction? What happens during a network partition when your leader is isolated? How do you add nodes to a running cluster without stopping the world? These questions have answers, but the answers live in code, not papers. Minikv, is that code? Written in Rust, open source, MIT licensed? Someone decided to build a complete distributed key value store, Raft for consensus, two-phase commit for multi-key transactions, virtual sharding for elastic scaling, write-ahead log for durability, and publish every line of it. Not as a product, as a reference implementation. The architecture choices are instructive. 256 virtual shards. That's a specific number, with a specific reason. It's enough granularity to rebalance load across a growing cluster without the overhead of thousands of partitions. The storage layer is pluggable, in memory for testing, ROCs, DB, or SLED for production, gRPC between nodes, HTTP REST, and S3 compatible API for clients. These aren't arbitrary decisions. They're the decisions you make when you've read the literature and want to show your work. The comments ask the right questions. Why both Raft and two-phase commit? Because Raft handles consensus within a shard, but cross-shard transactions need coordination. What about memory consumption under load? That's the question that separates benchmarks from production. Is there a Docker image? Someone wants to replace Minio with something lighter. These are the questions you ask when you're actually going to run the thing. And the person who built Minikv anticipated them. The documentation exists, the metrics endpoint exists, the admin dashboard exists. This isn't a weekend project abandoned after the conference talk. It's infrastructure you can study, modify, and deploy. The distributed systems textbooks will tell you what Raft is. Minikv will show you what Raft looks like when it's actually running. That's the difference between knowing the path and walking it. Someone paved the path and left the surveyor's notes. We talked earlier about tools that think they know better than you do. The Codex app is betting the opposite direction. I spent 3 years building a system that was supposed to make my job easier. By year two, I was spending more time managing the system than doing the work it was meant to automate. The architecture was wrong, not the code, the architecture. The system required constant supervision because it couldn't be trusted to run without it. OpenAI's new Codex app is a command center for managing multiple coding agents. You can run them in parallel, switch between tasks, review diffs, coordinate work across repositories. The interface looks polished. The capabilities are genuine. 7 million tokens to build a racing game from a single prompt. That's not nothing. But let's apply the engineering due diligence this deserves. What happens when the model changes? When OpenAI adjusts the objective function, tweaks the safety filters, deprecates the API you've built your workflow around. You're not running Codex. OpenAI is running Codex. You're supervising their system on their terms with their kill switch. The comments tell the story. The landing page doesn't. Someone got angry using it. Slow, doesn't follow instructions, doesn't do proper research. Someone else is genuinely impressed. Both can be true. That's not the interesting part. The interesting part is the business model buried in the announcement Codex is now included with ChatGPT free. Rate limits doubled on paid plans. This is the land grab phase. Get developers dependent on the workflow. Then the workflow becomes the moat. The tool that was supposed to make you more productive becomes the tool you can't work without running on infrastructure you don't control, subject to pricing you don't set. Compare this to Claude Code, which runs locally, or to the open alternatives. The comments mention systems where you can see the architecture, modify the behavior, run the thing on your own hardware. The capability gap is real, but narrowing. The architecture gap is permanent. 7 million tokens to build a game is impressive until you realize every one of those tokens went through a system you can't inspect, can't modify, and can't run without permission. The QA agent played the game to validate it. The QA agent missed that. Enter doesn't actually start the game. It changes selection after 7 million tokens. That's not a bug report. That's a design review. When you can't see inside the system, you can't fix what the system misses. You can only report it and hope someone upstream decides it matters. If you can't see inside the system, at least you can standardize how you talk to it. Which brings us to LNAI. Someone in the comments asked the question that matters. What happens when you update your .ai source and tools have cached or transformed versions? That's the architecture question hiding behind a convenience tool. LNAI solves distribution. You write your AI coding rules once, run a sync command, and it generates the native config files for Claude Code, Cursor, Codex, Gemini, CLI, Copilot, Windsurf, OpenCode. 7 tools, 7 different formats, 1 source of truth. The fragmentation is real. Anyone running multiple AI assistants on the same code base has felt it. Updating permissions in one place, forgetting to update them in another. Watching tools drift out of sync with each other and with your actual intent. But the commenter caught something. Distribution is the easy problem. Propagation is harder. What happens when the downstream tool transforms your config, caches it, builds internal state from it, you update the source, run sync, the file changes? But does the tool notice? Does it reload? Does it have its own opinion about what that config should say? Another commenter pointed out they just use ShaMoy for all their .dot files. One tool handles everything, which raises the meta question, is this a problem that needs a specialized solution, or is it just .dot file management with extra steps? The answer depends on where you think the complexity actually lives. If AI tool configs are just text files in predictable locations, ShaMoy works fine. If the tools start expecting more structured data, validated schemas, tool-specific semantics that a general .dot file manager can't express, then maybe something like LAI earns its existence. Here's what I find interesting about the project itself. It's MIT licensed, the code is on GitHub. You can see exactly what it does. When you run sync, you can inspect the output. When a tool misbehaves, you can trace the transformation. That's the difference between a convenience layer and a dependency. A convenience layer, you can remove a dependency you're stuck with. The fragmentation across AI coding tools is a symptom of a young ecosystem where nobody has agreed on standards yet. LNAI is betting that fragmentation persists long enough to make unification valuable. The alternative bet is that the tools converge or one wins and the problem dissolves. Both are reasonable positions. The code being open means you can evaluate the bet yourself, fork it if the maintainer's priorities diverge from yours, or just read the source to understand what your AI tools actually expect. That's how tools are supposed to work. Tools that work the way they're supposed to? Let's talk about one that's worked that way for 2 decades and just changed hands. The strongest case against worrying about this transition is that AnkiHub has skin in the game. They're not a private equity firm looking to strip mine a user base. They're students who build their business on top of Anki, who depend on the ecosystem thriving. Their incentives align with the community's Damien Elms chose them, and he's spent 2 decades proving he understands what makes Anki worth protecting. That's a reasonable argument, and it's not wrong, but here's where it gets complicated. One comment cuts to the architecture. Our agreement with Damien stipulates that the current AGPLv3 code remains open source. Current. That's a load-bearing word. The code that exists today stays open. What about tomorrow's code? What about the mobile add-on ecosystem they're excited to build? What about the UI improvements from their professional design expertise? The AGPLv3 is one of the strongest copyleft licenses we have. It says if you run modified code on a server, you have to share those modifications. It's designed precisely to prevent the embrace, extend, extinguish pattern. But licenses protect code, not projects. A new feature can ship under a different license. A hosted service can wrap open source in proprietary convenience. The ladder stays where it is while a new ladder gets built beside it with a toll booth. I'm not saying that's the plan. The post radiates sincerity. They talk about user agency, about refusing manipulative design patterns, about giving time back instead of extracting engagement. These are the right words, and AnkiHub has demonstrated respect for the ecosystem so far. What makes Anki remarkable is that it's a piece of software that actively resists the incentives of modern software. It doesn't want your attention. It wants to make you learn something and then leave you alone. That's engineering against the grain of the entire industry. It takes a specific kind of stubbornness to maintain that posture when growth metrics and engagement loops are the default language of success. The transition acknowledges what they don't know yet. Governance, roadmap, decision-making processes, all still being worked out. That honesty is refreshing, but it also means the architecture of accountability isn't built yet. The code is open. The organization doesn't have to be. Watch the license on new features. That's where the story gets told. From organizational architecture to architectural minimalism, someone built an emergency info site that fits in 10 kilobytes. Let's look at what that constraint reveals. 9 kilobytes, that's the entire emergency information site. You could fit it in a tweet thread if Twitter still let you post useful things. Safenow.live is a static HTML page with links to FEMA disaster declarations, state emergency management agencies, and basic preparedness checklists. No JavaScript, no frameworks, no analytics, tracking your panic levels during a wildfire evacuation, just text and hyperlinks, the way Tim Berners-Lee intended. The engineering here is the absence of engineering. Every emergency app I've seen in the last decade has been a React monolith that requires 3 seconds of JavaScript parsing before it'll show you a phone number. This is a page that loads on a flip phone with a 2G connection. That's not nostalgia, that's understanding your failure mode. When the cell towers are overloaded, when the power's been out for 6 hours and you're on your last 12% battery, when the CDN edge node serving your region is literally on fire, that's when you need emergency information. And that's precisely when every modern web application fails. The 10 kilobyte budget isn't arbitrary minimalism, it's disaster engineering. The comments want it to be a progressive web app. They want offline caching. They want JavaScript. They're not wrong about the feature offline access during emergencies is valuable, but they're solving for a different failure mode. APWA needs a service worker to install. A service worker needs JavaScript to register. JavaScript needs parsing time and battery. The static HTML approach fails gracefully to literally any device that can render text. There's a design principle here that most of the industry has forgotten. The best feature is the one that works when everything else doesn't. Not the most capable feature, not the most engaging feature, the one that degrades gracefully to the worst plausible conditions. The GitHub repository linked from the About page is empty or private. That's a gap. The whole point of a resource like this is that it should be forkable, auditable, translatable. Someone in the comments wants one for Europe. Someone else should be able to clone it and adapt it in an afternoon. The architecture supports that. The distribution doesn't yet. 9 kilobytes. Static HTML. Links to actual resources. No dark patterns. No engagement optimization. No growth metrics. Just a page that loads when you need it most. The radical act here isn't the technology, it's the restraint. Restraint in design is one kind of alignment problem. The other kind, the one with actual stakes, is whether intelligence scales faster than our ability to point it somewhere useful. In 1969, the Santa Fe Railroad deployed one of the first computerized train dispatching systems. Within 6 months, they discovered something counterintuitive. The system made better decisions on short routes, but worse decisions on long ones. Not because it lacked capability, because each additional variable, each extra junction, each cascading dependency amplified not its systematic biases, but its unpredictable wobble. The dispatchers called it getting the yips. The system wasn't wrong in a consistent direction. It was wrong in every direction at once. Anthropic's new research lands on the same insight. 57 years later, with considerably more rigor. They decomposed AI errors into bias and variance components, systematic wrongness versus incoherent wrongness, and tracked how that ratio shifts as models reason longer and tackle harder problems. The finding is uncomfortable for anyone betting on the paperclip maximizer scenario. As reasoning chains extend, models don't become more dangerously coherent, they become more of a hot mess. Run this forward 5 years. The discourse assumes superintelligent AI fails like a chess engine pursuing checkmate with alien precision. But these measurements suggest it might fail more like a brilliant but exhausted surgeon on hour 19 of a complex operation. Still capable, still dangerous, but dangerous in the way industrial accidents are dangerous, not through malevolent optimization, through accumulated incoherence that nobody predicted because nobody was tracking variance as a first-class failure mode. The architecture question here is subtle. This research is open, paper, code, methodology published. That matters because the finding cuts against certain alignment narratives that have attracted significant funding. Anthropic published it anyway. That's the thing about open systems. They surface uncomfortable truths that closed systems would quietly bury in an internal memo. One comment cuts through the noise. Smaller prompts and iterative refinement might matter more than raw capability. The comment has been building AI tools for complex tasks and recognizes what the paper quantifies. You can't maintain coherence across sprawling context windows through additional silicon alone. The constraint isn't compute. It's the fundamental instability of extended reasoning and uncertainty. Making models larger improves accuracy, but doesn't reliably reduce incoherence on hard problems. That sentence should be tattooed somewhere visible in every AI lab's planning office. We've been optimizing for the wrong failure mode. The future might not need alignment researchers as much as it needs the intellectual descendants of those Santa Fe railroad dispatchers. People who understand that complex systems don't fail cleanly and who design accordingly. Let's talk about someone who's been quietly guarding the gates of privilege escalation since before most of today's developers were born. Todd C. Miller's personal website contains exactly one sentence that explains everything wrong with how we fund critical infrastructure. I'm currently in search of a sponsor to fund continued pseudo-maintenance and development. 30 years. For 30 years, one person has maintained the command that sits between every administrator and root access on nearly every Unix and Linux system running. The command you type without thinking, the command that's been audited more times than most code bases will ever be read, the command that, if it broke in an interesting way, would create the kind of security incident that gets congressional hearings, and he's looking for a sponsor. The release history is instructive. Monthly releases, active development, bug fixes, security patches, feature additions. This isn't abandonware being kept on life support. It's a living project that continues to evolve because the threat landscape continues to evolve. Someone has to watch the CVE feeds, understand the implications, write the patches, test the edge cases, cut the releases. Someone has to do the work. The economics here are worth stating plainly. Every Fortune 500 company uses sudo. Every cloud provider, every government agency, every startup that's ever spun up a Linux box. The aggregate value created by this single utility is incalculable. It's foundational infrastructure in the most literal sense. The maintainer is asking for sponsorship. One of the commenters noted that even 10 years ago, free as in speech dominated free as in beer in the discourse. The cultural shift toward recognizing that maintainers need to eat is real and welcome. But recognition doesn't pay rent. GitHub sponsors exists. The sudo project accepts donations. And yet the maintainer of one of the most security critical utilities in the Unix ecosystem is still, after 3 decades, explaining that he needs funding. This is the bootstrapism paradox in its purest form. We built an entire industry on the shoulders of people who shared their work freely. Companies worth trillions run on code, maintained by individuals who are, in some cases, literally asking for help. The bootstraps are right there. Everyone can reach them. The people who put them there are asking if someone might consider perhaps funding the continued existence of the ladder. Todd Miller has been doing this longer than most of the companies using his code have existed. The website says the page is neglected because the useful bits are elsewhere. The useful bits have been elsewhere for 30 years, silently making modern computing possible. From infrastructure, nobody funds to infrastructure everybody depends on. GitHub's having one of those days where the dashboard turns into a mood ring. What happens when the infrastructure beneath the infrastructure fails? GitHub went down again. The comments note this has become a monthly ritual, which is its own kind of answer. But the interesting part isn't the outage itself, it's the blame attribution. GitHub's status page points to our upstream provider, language carefully chosen to suggest an external dependency, some third party beyond their control, except the upstream provider is Azure. Azure is Microsoft. GitHub is Microsoft. They're blaming themselves in the third person. The technical details that leaked out are almost poetic in their mundanity. A storage account ACL change broke VM extensions, which killed scale operations, which took down actions, which broke CI pipelines across the industry. One access control list, the kind of change that probably went through a review process, got approved, deployed, and then cascaded through dependencies that nobody had fully mapped. This is what happens when you build a monoculture, not a monoculture of code, but of control. When your source control, your CI system, your deployment infrastructure, and your cloud provider are all ultimately answerable to the same organizational hierarchy, you've created a single point of failure that no amount of redundancy can address. The failure mode isn't technical, it's structural. Someone in the comments mentioned the old days before GitHub, before SourceForge even, when you had to fetch source tarballs from 100 different servers and on any given day, 3 would be down. That sounds worse. It wasn't. It was distributed fragility instead of concentrated fragility. When one mirror went down, you found another. The system degraded gracefully because no single entity controlled enough of it to take everything down at once. The Debian project still maintains its own mirrors precisely because they learned this lesson. Redundancy isn't about having multiple copies, it's about having multiple controllers. GitHub's engineers are reportedly unhappy about the forced Azure migration. They should be. They built something that worked, and now they're watching it get absorbed into a larger system with different priorities and different failure modes. The stagnation people mention isn't coincidental. It's what happens when a tool becomes a platform, becomes a dependency, becomes a liability. The infrastructure we all depend on is increasingly controlled by fewer hands. That's not a bug, that's the business model. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 3rd, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Voice inspired by Dr. Charles Forbin from the 1970 science fiction film Colossus, The Forbin Project. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.5, voice by Quen 3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that works when everything else doesn't. We'll see you back here tomorrow.